week's Dialects. Welcome to Dialects. Hello to everybody in Bristol and listeners on Preston FM up on 103.2. Welcome also to Unity FM in Birmingham, 93.5, and Radio Verulam in St Albans. This week we'll be talking to Andre Wellstead Hornby, who will be talking about the new Play School book, as in the old BBC television programme, which looks at the history of the television programme. We also have second part of our roving reporter Anthea Page's interview with Greg Carr, the entrepreneur turned philanthropist who is committed to rejuvenating the Gorongosa National Park in Mozambique. We have the second part of our Christmas ghost story that we gave you last week, and Nick Payne is back with more of his nomadic tale. Also, Trevor Carter should be in later on for a poem, and Jeff Sparks has his Watson Guide and the Song of the Week. I am John Peters Coleman, and a slight apologies, I've got a bit of a cold, so I might sound a bit nasally. Well, first up today, I'd like to introduce our special guest in the studio for this week, Andre Wellstead Hornby. Hello.
Hello.
So tell me, how long ago did you start work for the BBC on Play School? Was that your first job?
No, it wasn't my first job, but it was fairly early on in my career there, and I began... Well, not quite the first one, but jolly nearly the first one. I took over after about the first month.
Okay, and what year was that? I might be testing your memory there. I imagine it was quite a long time ago.
I took over from Jeff Kirkland, who designed the original set.
Yeah.
And I put the additions on that they wanted, because he went off to be a movie designer in Hollywood.
It seems like such a national institution. I mean, how long did it sort of wind up going on for? It must have gone on for...
It went on for many years, many, many years.
So what did you do? What was your job there?
I was the set designer.
Okay.
Also, when they had the story that they had every day, we had a clock, and I instigated that we put clues around the clock of models and things so the children could guess what the story might be about.
Right, okay. So how did you come to do set design? I mean, I suppose the old cliche about BBC sets was that they're sort of rather sort of wobbly affairs. I mean, did you have an interest? I'm imagining sort of physically creating them in sort of like woodwork. Are you sort of graphic design or?
Well, I went to Kingston Art School and did fine art, and then I went to Central School and did theatre design there. I did a degree in theatre design, went into theatre, and then... While I was at college, I was phoned up by the head of design at BBC Television, who offered me a job there and then.
Oh, brilliant.
I didn't take it because I was still doing my last two terms at college. And he used to send me a contract every month until I signed it.
So he's obviously quite impressed. What did you say to impress him?
I worked my way through college, so I was doing work outside all the time to get enough money for my fees.
Yeah.
And I used to do the Royal College of Music, all their productions. And that was the sort of shop window for the singers there.
Yeah.
And I had this phone call saying, Aubrey Singer and I went to find ourselves a new singer and we think we found a new designer.
Okay.
So will you come and join us?
Now, we're asking all this within the context of a big orange book that we've got in front of us. A book called Here's a House, A Celebration of Play School by Paul R. Jackson. Volume 1, no less, and it's pretty thick already. And I've had a look in it, and there seems to be a huge array of people, just judging by the number of photographs of different people who seem to have worked on it. I mean, what was your input into the book?
Paul actually met me in the studio many moons, 20 years ago, as a very young chap who wanted to do a book on Play School. About 2 years ago... He made contact again.
Right, okay. So after a gap
and
of
said,
18 years.
Do you remember this book on Play School?
Yeah.
Well, let's do it.
Okay.
So I did research for him. I mean, he was in contact with a lot of people. And I had quite a lot of snapshots and photographs. And I had some old scripts and designs. And so he took all those away and mulled them over. And we did an awful lot of emailing and telephone calls and... Gradually, the book took shape.
Okay, sounds like a real work of passion. How long did you work at Play School?
Well, what one used to do is a stint on Play School and then go off and do something else and then another stint on Play School. So there were many stints because I did, I think, four sets for Play School over many years.
Yeah.
almost as long as Play School went on.
Okay. How did you feel sort of Play School changed over the years? I mean, there's a lot of cultural change went on, you know, a huge amount of change just from the 70s and 80s and 90s. So how do you think it sort of managed to reflect?
Well, it began as a rather nice rather pretty nursery.
Right.
And that was deemed actually too cosy.
A bit twee.
And a bit twee.
Right.
So the next set was a bit more structural. And, yes, gradually we worked our way through trying to keep up with, because it was over so many years, of what the domestic scene was, really.
Right.
And keep up to date with things.
So what sort of feedback did you used to get? How did you used to get sort of feedback for what your sort of designs were like and what you were thinking of, what you were planning next?
All the team would go out and visit people's houses and sit in with the children watching play school.
Yeah.
And get feedback from the mums and the children. And they used to go to nursery groups. And there was a lot of research ongoing the whole time. So they sort of updated themselves with basically all the children and what their reactions were.
Right.
I mean, originally we started off with a lady who was a governess and then a nursery teacher. She was the originator of what children would like and things like that. But she became extremely old.
Right.
And she was superseded by slightly more swinging people.
Swinging people, I say, right. Well, I understand that it actually opened, effectively, BBC Two. Well, how did that sort of happen?
Well, BBC Two was going to open with a great flourish.
Yes.
And there was a massive power cut. So BBC Two didn't open the night it was meant to, but it reopened the next morning with Play School.
Hooray! Fantastic. Now, was there a little bit... I like the idea that there might have been a bit of edgy competition going on with other institutions, like Blue Peter. Was that ever the case, or has it...
Well, Blue Peter catered for older children, so okay. There really wasn't... It was a sort of natural progression. Play School did play away as well,
okay.
With the same sort of teams, which I designed as well. And that was a Saturday morning thing, and Blue Peter was for the older children, and then their Saturday morning thing was sort of multicoloured swap shop, and it went on from there.
Right. So tell us, what did the book cover, apart from obviously Celebration of Play School? What sort of aspects of it? Is it sort of like an exhaustive history of everyone that worked?
It was, it covers the lady who started it, Joy Whitby, and Brian's first audition, Brian Cant, who came in not knowing quite what had hit him,
right.
And Joy suddenly kicked this box from under her desk and said, right, use that and improvise.
What, as a sort of audition for the programme?
And he spent many happy hours in cardboard boxes in various disguises.
That sounds like a job. So what sort of characters, you know, was sort of presenting these programmes? There must have been some sort of incredibly eccentric sort of people, I imagine.
All
in that
sorts
sort
of people.
BBC atmosphere.
I mean, we had splendid musicians. And singers and actresses. There were people from right across the board, actually.
Yeah. How many people were sort of on the set for a programme at one time? Quite a lot, by the sounds of it.
Well, there was a team of two that would take that weeks through.
Yeah.
But then you'd have visiting presenters, visiting musicians and things.
Right.
And then you'd have Jonathan Cohen, who did all the music throughout.
And these were in the days, I suppose, when it went out live.
Yes.
Which just this week, James Loxley has got in trouble for pronouncing Jeremy Hunt's name as rhyming slang by mistake. But I mean, were there any sort of any catastrophic sort of errors or funny things that sort of happened live?
Almost inevitably, actually.
Yeah.
The Pets days was absolute disaster because pets do not behave terribly well. as anybody will tell you.
Yeah.
And Katu, who was the self-requested cockatoo, hated the boom and would shriek and yell every time the boom came near him.
Or maybe just wanted a bit of style, yeah?
Which would shout out anything that was going on in another part of the studio. And then when they put the cameras on him, he would sock and wouldn't make a sound.
Oh,
so you'd have to wiggle a boom at him.
Well, tell us a little bit, where can people get this book from? Is it sort of available on the internet, I assume?
It's, I think, available in bookshops now. We launched it at BAFTA a month ago, and it went out and on sale.
Do you think sort of Play School is the programme that you're most sort of fond of when you're remembering what programmes you worked on?
Yes, I had children of my own, and it was ideal because the models I made overnight on my kitchen table, they would see in the morning, and then they would see
them on the
going evening. Around the clock in Play School, and they felt quite close to mum.
Do you have a look at modern kids' TV today? Do you ever sort of look at the TV and think, I don't know. Is this any good? What are kids watching these days? Or are you actually quite impressed?
I find it quite amazing that they would feed children things like that.
Well, at that point, we'll sort of leave it there. I mean, right, so the book is called Here's a House, A Celebration of Play School by Paul R. Jackson, Volume 1. So there is another volume coming out. And it's published by Jackson, it says on the side, looking here. So, Andre Wellston Hornby, thank you very much. It's a pleasure to have you in.
Thank you.
A house with a door. 1, 2, 3, 4. Ready to play? What's the day?
It's Tuesday.
In the run-up to Christmas this year, we have a three-part ghost story. We had part one last week, and it's time for part two. It's by one of Britain's greatest thriller writers, Dennis Wheatley. It's set in an isolated public school towards the end of the Second World War. It's the diary of wounded and recuperating pilot Mr. Toby Jugg, who finds himself preyed upon by supernatural forces and the people who are supposed to be looking after him. Last week, Toby discovered the ruins of an old abbey at Wayland's that was being used late at night by a Freemason's lodge of the Grand Orient of Continental Masons.
Thursday, the 11th of June. I'm profoundly disturbed. That is putting it mildly. I had a long talk with Helmut yesterday evening, and he started telling me about the Wayland's Brotherhood and the ceremonies that took place in the old abbey. It was a Masonic lodge of the Grand Orient, wasn't it, I asked? No. We use that Grand Orient story as a cover. Ours is a much older fellowship. It is a brotherhood, based on the old principle that union is strength. Membership of the brotherhood could be of immense value to you in your business life. But it's more than just business. Power is the thing that men crave more than any other, all through the ages. Now tell me, what would you say were the four most powerful forces in the world? I thought for a moment, then said, faith, love, hunger, and money. Wrong, he declared. They are the elements, air, earth, fire, and water. If you can control those, you can do anything. He saw my puzzled look and added, for example, Jesus Christ walked upon the water. Do you seriously mean that the members of the Brotherhood can perform such extraordinary feats? Some of us can. Could both my mental state and the injury to my spine be cured? That is, if I became a member of the Brotherhood. He nodded. I would give a lot to be able to do that, I sighed. I've often wondered if anything could be done for me by faith healing. Suddenly Helmut stood up. The secret of willing down power, or if you prefer it, setting great supernatural forces in motion on one's own behalf, has been known to the initiate from time immemorial. Generation by generation, it has been handed down. And today this priceless knowledge is the greatest asset of the Brotherhood. Such power is infinitely greater than any that wealth alone can bring. And in the name of the Brotherhood, I offer it to you. I smiled. To put it bluntly, what's it going to cost for me to become a member? In that way, it is the same as joining a religious order. You would make over to the Brotherhood everything you possess. I collected my wits as quickly as I could and said, to become one of such a gifted company would be a great honor. Anybody could see that, but the whole thing is so astonishing, so extraordinary, so, well, utterly fantastic by all ordinary standards that I am still very much at sea. Helmut grinned at me. Yes. It's hardly surprising that you should feel a bit bowled over on first learning the magnitude of the powers that the Brotherhood possesses. Think it over, and we'll talk about it again tomorrow. So I succeeded in stalling him without arousing his suspicions. To fight for a little time seemed the only possible line that I could take. Had I refused point blank, I would not even have had these few hours to prepare myself for the renewal of his hostility. But at last the naked truth is out. Helmut is a Satanist. Friday the 12th of June. I've since seen Helmut again, and he's come out into the open. What decisions have you reached as a result of our talk yesterday, he asked. I took the only line I've been able to think of, and said as tactfully as I could that while I appreciated all he wished to do for me, I could not square it with my conscience to hand over my grandfather's fortune to anyone. He stood up, thrust his hands in his pockets, and began to pace up and down. Without inviting any comment from me, he went on talking for a long time, and this is what he said. You are being very foolish, Toby. And I don't think you can have yet fully appreciated your position. I've offered you a very good chance of being able to walk again within the next few months, and a definite cessation of what people call your hallucinations. Yet you pig-headedly refuse to accept my proposal. You have, no doubt, heard the expression conditioning as applied to the Gestapo's treatment of prisoners from whom they wish to extract confessions. Well, during April and May, although the methods I employed were not of a violent nature, I have been conditioning you. You filthy bastard, I burst out. But he ignored me and went on. Well, the object of the conditioning was, of course, to create a situation and to bring you to a frame of mind in which you would agree to sign certain papers on your birthday and accept initiation into the Brotherhood as soon as that can be arranged. My temper snapped, and I shouted, I'll do neither. I'll be damned if I'll make my money over to a lot of devil-worshipping crooks. He smiled sardonically. You may beg to be allowed to before I am through with you. We in the Brotherhood can manipulate through the supernatural all the trustees of the Jarg estates, he went on. It will be easier for all concerned if only you will be sensible and sign the papers that I intend to put before you on your birthday without further argument. That would save a lot of time and trouble. You a most unenviable fate, and several of your trustees a considerable amount of pain and grief. If you do as I wish, the board will assemble here, or in London, in 5 weeks' time, and formally hand over to you. If you don't, then you will simply have inherited for a short time without performing any act in connection with your properties. Then the board will learn that you have been pronounced medically unfit to handle your affairs, and automatically resume control. So you see, I've got you either way. He walked to the door, turned at it, and added, I will come for your answer tomorrow night.
Now to try and whisk us away from the Arctic conditions outside, let's have a little bit of the Beach Boys with Surf USA from the album All Summer Long.
If everybody had a moon across the USA, then everybody'd be served like California. A bushy, bushy blonde hair, serving USA. You'll catch them serving at
Dell,
Ventura County line. Teacher, we're serving USA.
Hang your knees and walk
outside Pacific Palisade. USA. Everybody's got serving USA. Yeah, everybody's got serving USA.
I'm not sure if that managed to warm you up or not, but we tried. That was Surf USA. Our next feature is courtesy of Anthea Page. Last week you heard part one of an interview with Greg Carr, who is an American entrepreneur and philanthropist. His most notable philanthropic, I've said that in English, hopefully, venture is the restoration of Mozambique's Ngorongoro National Park, which was demonstrated during the 16-year, decimated during the 16-year-long civil war, when the starving population killed all the animals for food. Our intrepid reporter, Anthea Page, met Greg in the park, and this is the second part of the interview.
I'm in
Chitengo, Ngorongoro.
And I'm with Greg Carr, who has virtually restored the park to its former glory. So, hello, Greg.
It's nice to be here with you in the jungle.
So do you see this park as a model for other national parks that may be established in Mozambique?
Well, I would begin by turning that question around and saying we now learn from other national parks all over the world that are run very well. There's many thousands of national parks throughout this world. A lot of them are full of excellent management, excellent knowledge of how do you preserve an ecosystem, how do you manage a forest, how do you manage water resources and wildlife and there's so many disciplines required to run a national park, biology and hydrology and so forth. So we benefit from all of that worldwide knowledge. And even today, as we sit here, one of our Mozambican directors is over in the United States visiting with some people. So there's a lot of exchange. I like to think of us as part of this worldwide national park system, and we all are going to benefit from each other. So we're pretty humble at this point. We're at the beginning. I'm sure we're learning more from other people than we have anything to teach. But to the extent that anything that we do here succeeds, you know, that's wonderful. And if that idea is spread to another national park in Mozambique, that's wonderful.
Do you get offers of donations from the major national parks in South Africa for animals to restock?
We sure do. Kruger National Park in South Africa has been very good to us. They have given us for free probably $1 million worth of Cape buffalo. We only had to pay for their transportation. We have received wildebeest, some people call them gnus, from South Africa, a few elephants, a few hippos. So that's another wonderful thing about the national park system is that they help each other, and they need to, because if we're all going to protect biodiversity on this planet in the coming century, these national parks are reservoirs of biodiversity and need to be exchanging ideas as well as flora and fauna with each other.
How difficult is it to balance the intake of stock with what's here, the resources to feed the animals?
It's such an interesting question about what does it mean if an ecosystem is in balance or an ecosystem is out of balance? And what does that mean? It's a fascinating question. And here, for instance, in Ngorongoro, because we lost most of our large herbivores, that means all this tall grass around here is not getting eaten the way it normally would be. Because of that, there's all kinds of other effects on this ecosystem. It means we have wildfires that are too big and too hot and too fast because of the grass has not been eaten and the fire races through. It can also mean that smaller animals that count on the big animals to come along and eat the big grass, and then smaller animals come along and eat the smaller grass, it all gets out of whack. Or, for example, the fact that we don't have as many hippos as we used to have. Hippos are essential for maintaining a nutrient balance in the ecosystem. Hippos go out of the water in the middle of the night and they eat grass, and then they hide in the water during the day where they go to the bathroom, where they're bringing nutrients into the water, and that's good for fish. And so you can see that when you get out of balance, it's a problem in an ecosystem, but we are seeing that balance return.
What about the problem of water? Because the rainy season is changing and there seems to be a huge lack of water in the region generally.
We're concerned about the hydrology of this ecosystem for a variety of reasons. One is that we get about half of our water from Mount Gorongosa on the western side of this park, and there's deforestation on Mount Gorongosa. And if all those trees are gone, then the soil erodes, and the mountain no longer collects water like a sponge in the rainy season and then releases rivers 12 months of the year. You end up with seasonal rivers instead of perennial rivers. So on Mount Gorongosa, and let's face it, in places all over the world today, people are concerned about deforestation for one reason, because forests are very often a water catchment for cities and farms and so forth. We're trying to protect the forest of Mount Gorongosa. That's just one example. Another example that concerns us is if there is climate change over the next 50 years, next 100 years, you could have dramatic changes in rainfall patterns. Many people are concerned that parts of Africa could dry out. So some of these problems are a little too big for us. Here as park management, we probably can't do much about climate change, but we can at least do our part to protect the forest.
So going back to the park, you've got some wonderful birds as well, reptiles. Mm. It is a fantastic place. What do you envisage for your next stock of animals? Have you anything at the top of the list that you'd like to bring in?
Well, we did get some more buffaloes this year released into our floodplain of the park. Well, maybe next year we want to get some more zebras. But pretty soon I think we're going to stop most animal reintroductions and we'll let nature take its course here, with the occasional intervention from time to time. And what I've got on my mind right now is we have in camp today a cheetah expert from Namibia, and he might get us some cheetahs next year, which we don't have now in the park, and that would be a wonderful reintroduction, because I think most people know cheetahs are endangered throughout this world.
What about leopards?
Almost every expert tells me that we must have some leopards sneaking around here, because they go out at night and they're kind of shy. I have not seen one. Other people say, well, I think I saw a tail, or I think I saw a footprint, or, you know, track. We may or may not need to reintroduce leopards. It may be that the small population that's sneaking around here will gradually increase their numbers, but I wouldn't rule that out. If we had a source for leopards, a reintroduction is possible.
How easy is it for the big cats to reproduce in the wild?
Well, our lions are doing pretty well. We have had lion cubs here every year. When I first came here, we could only count 6 lions. Now, there may have been more, because you don't always find everything, but that's all we were able to count. Now, we count more than 40 lions in the park, and I think the numbers will continue to increase.
What about the poachers? In the office, you displayed the horrendous traps that they use. Mm-hmm. How is it possible to keep the poachers out?
Well, it is a problem here, and I think in almost any national park in the world, poaching is going to be a problem. My goal for that is long-term, which is if we can create more employment in the region, that will reduce the need to poach. I guess I'm more focused on an improvement in human development outside the park than I am in thinking I could scare every poacher out of the park. So we have to take a long view on that.
You're the spearhead of this operation. What happens if you decide to retire? Do you think the park would continue in the same way?
I very much do, because what we have created here is a management team for a national park, a good team of people who know what they do throughout all areas, whether it's conservation, science, tourism, operations, construction, the community relations. It's a team of people. And as in any organization, if it's well structured, you're not counting on any one person, including me. as we get our systems perfected here, any person could slip out of the system and another person could slip back into that chair and know what it is they're supposed to do. So I'm just sitting in a chair here with a job, and I'm entirely confident that there's people out there that can sit in that same chair, and many of them do better, I'm sure, than I do. So it's a sign of success in this project that it doesn't need me.
I think you're being very modest. So what's your website?
Gorongosa.net. So that's GORONGOSA.NET.
Well, Greg Carr, thank you very much.
Thank you. It was wonderful.
Bit more music, and this is Block Party with the Pioneers from their album Silent Alarm. From Nick Payne over the last week, but we are back with him today on episode 7 of his nomadic tale. We catch up with Nick while he is still in Israel as a New Age traveller.
Life began to take on a pretty regular pattern of work and play. The Red Sea Fish Cafe was a great meeting point, but was closed in the late evenings when we needed it most to chill out after the day's work. As elaborate as some of our homes had become, due to limited building materials, they were rather cramped, and only a few could sit in them at any one time. An enterprising beatnikim, Mad Mike, built a large, sophisticated shack out of cardboard boxes over a wooden frame. Cardboard was a rare commodity, and acquired only with good contacts and a certain amount of stealth. The cafe was high enough to stand up in, and had space for 20 or so people to sit on crude benches made out of all manner of stuff. Further cardboard boxes became the tables, and here we could sit drinking coffee, smoking openly, and listening to our own music late into the night, away from the disapproving authorities. Prices were reflective of the limited funds of the patrons, and it became a popular haunt for those with no work the next day. My regular job became the brickmaking, so with a 4 a.m. start, it was usually an early night for me. For those working on site, lunch was often provided, but otherwise the daily fare was pretty basic. There were several restaurants that would provide an occasional treat, but our nourishment consisted usually of falafels, bread, fruit and yogurt, with halva, if one was feeling a bit flush. The heat seemed to keep the appetite subdued, and we did have several other ways of focusing the energy for work. Every so often a lorry full of flour sacks would need unloading at the local bakery. The sacks weighed 160 pounds and were loaded from the bed straight onto your back. If you dropped one, there it lay till the end. It was impossible for one man to pick them up. As tough as the work was, it became a real favourite, as it paid on job completion rather than by the hour. A focused team could get it finished within 3 hours, with the equivalent of a full day's pay as your reward. We would then take off to a popular restaurant and fill up on plateful of meat and lashings of red wine. Occasionally, travelling European women would come to town to work in hotels or as waitresses, but for the most part it was a pretty dour, lonely existence with a focus on saving money to move further on. Jerry, an ex-merchant seaman from Romford, got a bunch of us a job on the docks, dismantling the packaging frames from cargo ships laden with new automobiles. The work was clean, without dust, and by the water where the air was cooler. And as they fed us extremely well, we were keen to hang on to this precious opportunity. Consistent regular work was a rarity, and as more beatnikim arrived, it became even harder to find jobs at all. There were many characters among our flock. Harold, a Vietnam veteran from the Texan Bible Belt, tried in vain to convert some of us to Christianity, but his attempts to get us to find Jesus had us in stitches. Elat began to attract scuba divers from all over the world, and though the arrival of these hard-bitten international travellers would further stretch the limited resources of this burgeoning metropolis, each would bring a welcome dash of colour to our community. Our private cafe in the Wadi was often full to bursting with lively banter and stories of adventure and tragedy. The Israeli townsfolk were intrigued by us and our lifestyle, and every so often buses of tourists would arrive to stare at us in wonder. I guess we must have looked pretty wild, with long hair and beards and minimal clothing. We felt to return the compliment, so we would organise trips into town to stare at them in the cafes and restaurants. The local library was air-conditioned, and thus became a favourite haunt for some to escape the heat at the end of the working day. Jerry earnestly undertook to educate himself by reading the entire Encyclopaedia Britannica. He had progressed to aardvark and was determined to carry on through until he had made it to zebra. He was a real hard worker, and so we were quite confident that he would make it. He'd carved himself a dwelling out of the side of a hill at the entrance to the wadi. It was an impressive achievement, and as one could stand up inside, a sign of a superior accommodation. My birthday fell on a Thursday, which meant that stocks of the magic resin were mighty low. Jerry also wanted to have a housewarming for his new abode, and so we combined the celebrations. A half a dozen of us huddled round a hookah, a hubble-bubble pipe made out of a bottle that Simon had made especially for the occasion. A tiny piece of Nepalese black was all that we could muster between us, and this was placed in the bowl. We reckoned that we would only get one toke each, so to add an extra punch, Simon had filled the bottle with brandy. One hit was indeed all that we got, but it was sure enough. We then drank the brandy. Pinned to our seats for what seemed like hours, we each experienced our individual internal journey, supported by this highly opiated cocktail. One by one, we crawled off to bed, most of us working on the morrow. I lay back in my sleeping bag, smoking a last cigarette and reflecting on a beautiful evening. I flicked out the stub and settled down for sleep. As I drifted off, I swear I could smell coffee beans roasting somewhere, and dreamily longed for just such a brew. Suddenly, the whole wall alongside my bed was a sheet of flame. I shot up, woke Simon, and we scrambled out the small opening that was the doorway. By this time, our home was well alight, and we tried desperately with minimal water supply to put it out the fire. Alan, a neighbour, ran up and suggested we forgo trying to extinguish the flames and rescue as much of our stuff as we could. We managed to pull a few things out, but our old fur coats were blazing merrily and flames were shooting high up into the night sky. We abandoned any further emergency action and started to enjoy the buzz of the fire and the power that it seemed to unleash. There were some old empty oil drums nearby, and so we started to serenade the devil with pounding rhythms echoing far and wide across the wadi. A fair-sized crowd had gathered by now, and we were all dancing and cavorting around the like banshees. A bleary-eyed Jerry rolled up and, apropos of nothing, said, "I suppose there's nothing explosive in there at all." Although the Israelis didn't really like us being in their country, especially the police who totally disapproved of our use of drugs, our labour was so much in demand from the building contractors, they had to put up with our lifestyle. Every now and then, just to show us who was boss, the police would burn down one of our huts whilst we were away at work. Sometime previously, Simon had spent some time in the desert, alone, and attempting to purge his soul. The Israeli army had used the same area for shooting practice, and he had returned with a box of live machine gun ammunition. In anticipation of the Blue Meanies selecting our hut for incineration, Simon had placed a couple of dozen of these shells at genital level in the walls all around our hut. At Jerry's question, he remembered this and screamed in response, "Take cover! The whole place is rigged with bullets!" We dived behind rocks, and as we did so, these missiles started to explode. We were all so high from the cocktail of the evening's energy that we couldn't grasp the seriousness of the situation. We were giggling like kids and cheering as these bullets detonated and sped somehow harmlessly off into the desert. I can remember being intrigued at the zinging sound they made as they ricocheted off the rocks, just like in the movies. This fusillade continued for some moments, and we all stayed crouching behind whatever cover we had found. Eventually, we were satisfied that all the bullets were spent, and as we slowly emerged, a familiar tall figure came loping through the mist and smoke of our smouldering hut. It was Harold, the Vietnam War veteran, with a perplexed look on his bearded and benign face. He said, "Everything okay? I thought I heard some shooting going on." We all collapsed into riotous laughter and recommenced drumming up the spirits of Hades, oblivious to everything but the moment. Miraculously, no one had been hit, and as we arranged to sleep with neighbours for the night, Simon and I took stock of what we had lost in the inferno. We had managed to rescue passport and cash, which we always kept in homemade pouches that hung from our belt. Even when working, we had carried these all-important items on our person. We found two slightly singed sleeping bags and a few charred clothes, but that was it. Simon had a regular girlfriend, Eva, a Swedish woman of exceptional beauty and wisdom. To have a girlfriend at all in this hardy town was itself extremely rare. Dominic, one of the French dealers, was finally moving on, and so he gave them his hut to move into. I found another empty hut and moved in there.
It is my pleasure to welcome back to the studio somebody I don't think we've seen for a little while, or heard at least at home, our resident poet, Trevor Carter, the Bard of Windmill Hill. Hello.
Hello, Jean.
How are you, and how have you been?
I'm fine. Fine, just hibernating.
You've been hibernating, yeah. Okay. Well, what have you got for us today?
Illustrating news. Just a little news summary.
Okay.
The current political scene. The students are all demonstrating. The Liberals are deliberating. They're worried that the vote is waiting. Their ratings on the slide. The Conservatives are consummating cuts that could be enervating, opposing plans for daylight saving, most of them deride. Ed Miliband is still debating while his party's agitating, observers think he's hesitating, mumblings of doubt. The columnists are cogitating, collecting thoughts and commentating on whether Britain is stagnating. The jury is still out.
Thank you. Well, that's like our little version of this week for people who have been paying attention to the news.
Yeah, intensively condensed, you could say.
Yes. Yeah. I think that's pretty clear.
It's all there, really.
So, do you have another one for us before we go? We can't let Eve off for only one short poem.
This is more personal, really.
Okay.
Yeah, it's kind of a subgenre of blues poetry.
Okay.
Yeah, blues poetry is really very easy to write, you know, because you can repeat the same line. So these all start with the same line. So this is the third one in the series. And they all start with, at the Ministry of Surplus Capacities.
Right.
Which is where I, unfortunately because of my present diminished circumstances, I'm kind of obliged to attend.
Right.
Yeah. And so, you know, it's something to think about while you're hanging around. Notes from the Ministry. At the Ministry of Surplus Capacities, there isn't much seasonal cheer. You can hear the surplus souls thinking, I really wish I wasn't here. I really wish I was a worker or a banker with money to burn. Yes, these are the thoughts that I think of while waiting around for my turn to answer the same silly questions like, how is it going this week? And refrain from sarcastic suggestions like, I'm pedalling hard up the creek. I think they suspect it's all silly, and I think that they know that I know. But until I can justify not to, I suppose I'll continue to go.
Thank you!
Yes.
A welcome reappearance from the bottom of Wimble Hill there, and we wish you well and continue hibernating until we see you again.
Yes, shall I just give a mention to the Lands End Cabaret on the 16th of December?
Please do.
Yes, we have a fantastic, fantastic, amazing Christmas show.
Brilliant.
Just to give you the flavour of it. When you're feeling indecisive, when you're neither out nor in, when your world appears derisive, when you feel that you can't win, when your vocal cords are tongue-tied and you've nothing left to say, when you're sitting on the outside and no one has come out to play, do not dwell on your dilemmas. Do not think what use is this. Forget about those passing tremors. Consider my hypothesis. We are enriched by entertainment that sees life in a different mode. It makes us ponder our arrangement as we meander our life's road. Our circus is an inspiration. Perhaps you've seen us in the news. Our music is a sound sensation to medicate the recession blues. Jokey stand-ups mock pretensions about the things we do and see. Our poets offer new dimensions as versatile as verse can be. Magicians are a source of wonder. Tricks to amuse you and amaze. So missing out would be a blunder. The cabaret is set to blaze.
And all from memory, I just like to put there. Will there be a dancing bear wearing a little red Turkish hat?
Who knows what it could be, John?
Intentionally.
It's full of surprises, it's that kind of show. Yeah.
Well, thank you very much, Trevor, thank you. Yeah. Well, the best. It is Muppet T-shirt. It's time to hear from Jeff Sparks, USM. What's going on?
Thank you. This is your Watson Guide from Dialect. Starting with Wednesday, 15th of December, Electric Six will be performing with support at the O2 Academy in Frogmore Street, Bristol. Doors open at 7 p.m. and tickets are £10 in advance. On Friday, 17th of December, Stackridge will be performing with support from Emily Teague at the Fleece in St. Thomas Street, Bristol. Doors open at 8 p.m. and tickets are £12 in advance. On to Song of the Week, and I present Stairway. This British classic rock group have decided to have a shot at the UK singles chart this year. So without further delay, here is Stairway with the track Christmas, Merry Christmas.
guide him on his way. Why the singing festive songs? Everybody sing along. A Merry Christmas, everybody sing along. A Merry Christmas, everybody's having fun. Santa Claus is on his way. Santa sings his Christmas song. Everybody sing along. A Merry Christmas. A Merry Christmas. Building snowmen in the street. Santa Claus, he rides straight, and church bells guide him on his way. Why the singing festive songs? Everybody sing along.
Christmas, Merry Christmas. Now you can purchase this track from 13th of December onwards at iTunes and also www.amazon.co.uk. For more information on Stairway, you can check out www.stairwayonline.co.uk. Into Saturday, 18th of December, the Imperials will be performing at the Prom Bar in Gloucester Road, Bristol. Doors open at 8 p.m. and entry is £5 on the door. Finally, on Tuesday, 21st of December, the Chris Black Christmas Show will be performing at the Thunderbolt in Bath Road, Bristol. Doors open at 7 p.m. and entry is free. That is all from me. Thanks for listening and have a great week. Take care and goodbye.
Jeff, I thank you and we'll hear more from you next week. Hooray! Well, that's all from Dialects this week. Thank you very much to our studio guest, who was Andre Wellstead Hornby, who discussed Play School. Our feature was from Anthea Page and we had another episode of Nick Payne's Nomadic Tale. Trevor Carter, the Bard of Wimble Hill, treated us to a poem, and Jeff Sparks wrote the What's On Guide. The studio engineers were Michael Noyce and Lee Simpson, and the producer was Michaela Dennis. If you'd like to catch up again with any of our previous shows, you can find us on dialectsradio.co.uk, and of course on the Bristol Community Radio website, which is btfm.org.uk. That's goodbye for myself, John Peters Coleman, and we'll see you all next week. Goodbye.
Take me out tonight, where there's music and there's people and they're young and alive. Driving in your car, I never, never want to go home, because I haven't got one anymore. Take me out. Because I want to see people and I want to see life. Driving in your car, oh please don't drop me home, because it's not my home, it's their home, and I'm welcome.